Speaking up next is David Reuter on higher S matrices. So take it away.
Yeah, OK. Thanks for the introduction, and thanks for the invitation and the opportunity to speak here. First, a quick question. Can everyone in Zoom hear me and see the slides? I mean, I don't know how soon people will react to this, but I just assume it works. OK, so let's get going. I'm going to talk about some work in progress. If you want to see these slides, you can also download them at my webpage. And I want to stress, again, this is really work in progress. So please take everything that I'm going to say today with a grain of salt, maybe sort of not just a grain of salt, but some more salt. And what I'm going to talk about is the topic of higher S matrices and sort of higher invertible topological quantum field theories and higher non-invertible topological quantum field theories, and how sort of we imagine this all fitting together. So in a slide, what's the summary of my talk? Whenever I have a semi-simple anomalous n plus one dimensional topological quantum field theory, I'm going to tell you what I mean by these words in a second, then I can define a pairing. What am I doing? I take an operator of dimension k, an operator of dimension n minus k, and I take this operator of dimension k, put it on a k-sphere. I take this operator of dimension n minus k, put it on an n minus k-sphere, and I link these two spheres together in sort of a higher dimensional variant of a Hopf link, embed this whole thing into Rn plus 1. And if I furthermore assume that my TQFT does not have any local operators, I mean, a priori, this is a local operator, if I assume that the space of point operators is one-dimensional, as it happens so often for TQFTs, this will give me a number, a complex number. In fact, it turns out that this pairing descends to a certain quotient of these spaces of operators. Namely, I can consider these operators just up to condensation. And this pairing still makes sense. And again, I'm going to tell you, at least I'm going to give you an intuition of what I mean by that in a second. And once I'm sort of taking this quotient and sort of descended this pairing to this level of operators up to condensation, up to sort of gap boundaries between them, then it turns out that this pairing becomes non-degenerate. And actually, the converse is also true. If I have some relative TFT, some n plus one dimensional TFT, which lives on a boundary of some n plus two dimensional TFT, I can use this pairing to detect whether this relative TFT is actually an anomalous TFT. So in other words, whether this, whether the bulk theory is invertible as a field theory. So this, you might be familiar with this from the theory of modular categories and non-degenerate Prader diffusion categories. And the claim that I'm going to make here is that this whole story just continues to work in high dimensions, and again, that we just need this Hopf link pairing of spheres to detect invertibility. Okay, so now let's sort of take a step back and let me explain all of these words here. And along the way, let me explain what semi-simple higher categories are, what higher fusion categories are, and what all these words mean on this slide. So as a mathematician, the first thing you should notice is I do just want to work in a completely algebraic context. So my field theories are not unitary. My field theories don't have additional orientation. So a priori, they are just defined on framed manifolds, and you just have framed operators in them. So you might immediately spot an issue. I'm talking about spheres here, and I'm sort of not allowed to talk about spheres in an algebraic context because most spheres are not framed. And this is sort of the first thing that I have to fix up to make all of this sort of here rigorous and well-defined. And to do this, let's sort of go back to the one-dimensional situation. And let's sort of warm up. And let me say, everything that I'm going to say in the sort of first part of this talk are things that are really well-known and well-established, and I'm just going to sort of re-say them in a bit of a fancy language and give sort of a weird narrative about it. So nothing that's going to appear in this sort of part one is new, is mathematically sort of original content. It's just sort of the way it's phrased. And then in the second part, we're just going to higher dimensions, and there the material is new. OK, so let's get going. So let's sort of think about how to work with these operators. And let's first sort of imagine we are in a rigid monoidal category. So monoidal category, I think all of you know what that means. And rigid here for me just means that every object has a right dual and a left dual. And these duals don't necessarily need to agree. So in particular, I can have sort of these cup and cap string diagrams that we've now also seen multiple times. I can have, say, an object x, and I can sort of have this little string that turns around to the right, going to its right dual. I can also turn in the other way, sort of turn from x to its left dual. Now, but as you already see here, this is a right dual and this is a left dual. So these two objects are a priori different. And so in particular, I cannot form a circle. Because a priori, for that, I would have to identify left and right dual. And so in some sense, you could think of this notation as being bad. Really, what one should add to the notation, or at least sort of keep in the back of your mind, is that you have to record how often you've turned this string around. Somehow, if I start from here and go to the left dual, then here I'm somewhere at the double left dual, if you want. OK. So how to fix this? Or why is this the case? I mean, basically, to understand what's happening here, we should go to the Kobordism hypothesis, or rather to its embedded version, the Tangle hypothesis. And the Tangle hypothesis in this sort of case that we're looking at here basically says if I have a rigid monoidal category, as we've just seen, and I have an object in it, then I can evaluate this object on an embedded one manifold in two space, as long as I equip this embedded one manifold with the following additional data. I have to give it a tangential framing, so I have to take this tangent bundle of the manifold and trivialize it. I have to give it a normal framing, so similarly I have to normalize the normal bundle, to trivialize the normal bundle. And once I've done this, I have sort of two ways to go from the sum of the tangent bundle and the normal bundle to the trivial bundle in R2. One way is just take the trivialization of the tangent bundle plus the trivialization of the normal bundle. The other way is note that I'm embedded, so observe that the sum of the tangent and the normal bundle is just the tangent bundle of my ambient space. And then use the fact that my ambient space is just an R2, and this has some blackboard framing to trivialize it. And so the additional last piece of data I need to give is a homotopy, which makes this triangle commute. Okay? And here you see what goes wrong in this sort of example I gave on the last slide. Basically, the piece of data that I didn't sort of remember in my notation was this homotopy. This homotopy in this one-dimensional setting essentially records a winding number, how often your string has turned. So this is the piece of data that was just missing, and it just doesn't exist, and that's why I can't form circle on objects that just live in a rigid monoidal category if I don't equip them with extra data. And let me sort of use a notation or introduce a notation that I'm going to use throughout, and this is, again, just a notational piece. If I have an object X and I evaluate it on one of these embedded one manifolds, in this case just a one manifold, I'm just going to sort of pretend I'm integrating this object over this manifold. Of course, this is inspired from what actually happens in sort of actual physical QFTs, but in this topological setting, we just sort of use this as a piece of notation of evaluating an object X in a higher manifold. In this case, this lives in the endomorphisms of one. And let me also say, this whole procedure, you can sort of just as well replace R2, your ambient R2 in which you embed, by any other frame manifold. So if I have a frame 2 manifold, I can sort of write the same thing. I can have an embedded manifold in there, one manifold in there with a tangential framing, normal framing, and a homotopy where here you just use the framing of your ambient manifold. So that's sort of how you draw or how you embed these operators in this frame world. Okay. So let's sort of look at this again in sort of more detail, the same question we just had. So I can take X and I can sort of evaluate it on S0. This is just X times X dual. And we've also seen this evaluation morphism. This goes from X times X dual to the tensor unit. You can think of this as integrating over a disk. The point is now that you won't have a morphism which goes in this other direction for the reasons that sort of this framing isn't only bounding in one direction, if you want, if you sort of remember all of this framing data. However, the situation changes slightly if I'm in the semi-simple context. So let's now sort of assume we have a fusion category. And let's recall what a fusion category is. Again, we've seen fusion categories before this week. Here, a fusion category is a semi-simple category, which has a finite number of simple objects. I'm going to sort of denote the set of simple objects up to isomorphism by pi zero of C. And I also assume that the unit is simple. In this case, let's make the following just algebraic observation. An object X is simple if and only if I take X tensor X dual and sort of decompose it into its simple summands, the unit will appear, because X dual is the dual of X, but the unit will appear precisely with multiplicity 1. So that's one way to characterize when an object is simple. And so in this case, you can think of this evaluation morphism, it's some morphism from X tensor X dual to 1, as a projection. It sort of projects out the unit. And so since we're in a semi-simple category, I can find a splitting of this projection. I can first just find sort of a one-sided inverse to this projection. And in fact, I can find such a thing uniquely, right? There's a one-dimensional choice of sort of splittings up to scale, and if I say, oh, I want this to sort of normalize to one, there's a unique such guy, which I denote by sort of the evaluation of x cross. And it sort of is uniquely characterized by this equation. And that's all sort of really standard and basic, but the sort of perspective that I'd like you to take is to think of this as sort of an additional layer of sort of dualizability that simple objects in these monoidal categories have. Namely, you should think of this really as basically this equality you should think of as a two-disc, which bounds the circle. And therefore, the circle you should think of as equipped not with a framing, but with a so-called two-framing. So a framing of its tangent bundle plus a trivial bundle. So as if these diagrams would really live in an additional dimension, as if there would be sort of an additional dimension perpendicular to the plane. So that's sort of the first step. And that's what later on is going to allow me to draw spheres. So now I have sort of a way to think about what I mean by a sphere. Okay. And of course, another way to say this is that these choices that I'm making here, they lead essentially to a canonical isomorphism from the left dual to the right dual. But also, these choices are not monoidal. They're not compatible with the rest of the category structure. I can do them sort of separately, one object at a time. If I would have a monoidal such isomorphism, this is what the mathematicians or the fusion category theorists among you will know as a pivotal structure. And I might just not have a pivotal structure. Okay. But so the first takeaway is, once I'm in a semi-simple context, I have sort of this additional fractional type of dualizability behavior. I can sort of evaluate my objects on manifolds that have less sort of rigid framing requirements than in a sort of a plane n-categorical case. And you can sort of understand this from the perspective of the cobordism hypothesis as well, what happens here, but I won't say this. We can, if anyone's interested, we can talk about this later. Okay. So now, how to define an S matrix. If I'm in one of these braided monoidal categories, right, remember, I don't have a ribbon structure, I don't have a pivotal structure, I can't sort of just evaluate things in oriented manifolds, I have to be a bit careful. Well, what I do now is I use this thing we call a fake framing, or fake co-framing, to produce a matrix which takes an isomorphism class of a simple X and an isomorphism class of a simple Y. You put them together on a hop link, and that's a number. And that is the thing you call the S matrix. The S matrix you might be more familiar with comes about if you have an actual ribbon category, so if you have twists and orientations and all that around, and then it's just sort of away from this S matrix by a normalization. So the usual S matrix is just the dimension of X times the dimension of Y times this framed S matrix. Some particular invertibility of one is equivalent to invertibility of the other. So it's sort of a renormalization, but a renormalization that does not depend on this choice of pivotal structure. So that's really the sort of algebraic thing that underlies these S matrices. And let me sort of talk a bit about the main theorem that one then sort of proves about S matrices. And for that, let me sort of first give you the TGFT interpretation of such a braided fusion category that I think also most of you will be familiar with and that we've also sort of encountered during this week. I want you to think of my braided fusion category in a TGFT world as a framed four-dimensional bulk theory. And this goes sort of under the name of the Crane-Yetter theory or the Walker-Wang model. Together with a three-dimensional boundary theory. And this three-dimensional boundary theory is, of course, in the Reshetykin-Turayev theory. And sort of mathematically, these theories are both fully extended and valued in a certain reader four category.
David, there's a question in chat.
Yes.
Is there a notion of the quantum dimension of a simple object at this point?
There is something. So a priori, not really, because I've sort of chosen this to normalize to one, right? So you could say, oh, it's maybe one. There is something interesting you can do, which is to say, take, sort of compare the circle with the bounding framing to the circle with the co-bounding framing. And these two dimensions you will get out. Once I'm sort of fixing this to be one, I can also evaluate it on a co-bounding two-framing, and then I get some interesting number out, and that computes what in fusion category literature is known as the squared dimension of an object. So there's not quite a quantum dimension, but somehow its square is still well-defined, or its absolute value square or something. I mean, it's just a number you assign which computes as, which knows something about the quantum dimension. Okay, so with this interpretation, we can state this theorem, and this theorem goes back to many, many people, and sort of various different approaches, and I think So here's sort of the long list. So these are the people that I think should definitely be associated with this theorem, and maybe I've forgotten anyone. Then please, if anyone sort of has other references that should be added to this list, please tell me later. But the theorem is the following. You can think of this as sort of the fundamental theorem of braided fusion categories. This framed S matrix is invertible if and only if the so-called Müger center of C is trivial. The Müger center is precisely the subcategory of transparent objects. So this means if and only if whenever I have an object which braids trivially with any other object, it has to be trivial or some of sort of the vacuum. And this is true if and only if the four-dimensional bike theory, this thing here, is invertible. So that's a way to detect invertibility of the bike by somehow something, you know, very simple, some matrix being invertible. And really, I mean, what's cool about this and what's sort of exciting about this is that this is really a zero categorical statement. That's just something about a particular matrix you can write down. This is somehow a one categorical statement. This is checking whether a certain one category is trivial. And this is essentially a four categorical statement. This is asking, is an object in a certain four category invertible? So somehow this should be considered as being sort of a much simpler thing to ask than this here on this other side. Yes. So if you set everything up in a compatibly framed way, so Chris was asking whether I don't need a ribbon structure for anything here. If you set everything up in a compatibly framed way, you don't need a ribbon structure. I do agree that maybe I shouldn't then call it Richard Tikhon-Turayev and Crane Yetta. It's some frame variant of these.
But I do have a 3D theory even without the...
Yes. Yeah. You have a 3D boundary theory for this 4D theory. Yep.
Okay, thanks.
Yes. Okay. And of course, the term modular categories, where does it come from? We've also seen this week. A modular category is then you get exactly a ribbon or oriented category, so you have some data which makes this theory oriented together with this condition. And so if you say, let's sort of just try to understand this world algebraically or framedly, then this condition is somehow the interesting bit that's left of a modular category. Somehow the question of what higher modular categories are then boils down into sort of what does it mean to have sort of a higher oriented category together with what's this non-degeneracy condition. And the non-degeneracy condition is what I'm going to talk about now. Okay. So are there any questions up to this point? Okay. So then let's talk about the n-categorical version of the story. So first, to talk about this n-categorical version, I'd like to work in this framework of so-called multifusion higher categories or higher semisimple categories or higher fusion categories. And I want to give you sort of a very brief overview of what that means, what that data is. I don't want to go sort of too much into the details, but just to give you sort of a bit of a flavor what's happening there. So the slogan you should sort of take away, as a mathematician at least, is that a multifusion n plus one category is to a multifusion n category, as a multifusion one category is to a finite dimensional semisimple algebra. So if you understand finite dimensional semisimple algebras and multifusion one categories, and if you understand how they are related to one another, we should be able to understand this. And this leads to the following definition. A multifusion n category here is a C-linear monoidal n category such that it fulfills the following three properties. It has direct sums and all n categorical idempotents split. So this first condition is in some sense just a completeness condition. You can try to avoid it, but it's nicer to have it in there because then it's sort of complete under all physically sort of sensible operations you could perform. So I didn't tell you what n idempotent split means. We've also seen this a lot this week already, which I'm quite happy about because then I don't have to explain what this means. But this is essentially an n categorical version of what an idempotent is. And for large n, this was defined by Davide Gaiotto and Theo Johnson-Frid in this paper that also already came up. And physically, of course, we've also heard this, we can think of this condition, this sort of first condition is saying all operators or defects in my theory, which can be condensed, which can be sort of constructed by sort of a lattice model inside this theory from other operators that already exist, are also in C. So if I have a theory, a phase which lives in C, and I can do some condensation on that, some sort of higher operator condensation on this, I'll get out a new theory. This theory should also be in C. So this is basically, the first condition is a closure condition. It's just saying it contains everything that you can construct from things that are already in there. And the second condition is we want to have some, so this is a completeness condition. This is somehow more serious. This is in some sense the thing that enforces semi-simplicity. This is saying all the endomorphism algebras that I'm seeing here are multifusion n minus one categories. In particular, ones that are going sort of all the way to the top, a multifusion zero category is just a finite dimensional semisimple algebra. So this inductive definition then makes sense. And this is this trick that Andre mentioned this morning in his talk. Once I know that I have direct sums and that endomorphisms are semisimple, then it also follows that all of the other, that the whole sort of categories are semisimple. Okay. One more condition is it should be rigid. So all objects have duals. And in particular, then by induction, it follows that also all higher morphisms in there have adjoints. And lastly, there is a finiteness condition. A certain set associated to one of these multifusion n categories has to be finite. What this set is, I'm going to tell you in a second.
Great. There's a question in chat. What does the dual mean here physically? Is it the same thing as orientation reversal?
Yes, you can. Rather than orientation reversal, you can think of it as a version of a framing reversal. So yeah. Okay. And lastly, of course, here's the word multifusion appears a lot. What is that? Multifusion is basically what you know as fusion, but without the requirement that the unit is simple. In a second, I just go into sort of restrictive fusion higher categories, and those are again just multifusion, where I ask the unit to be simple. Now, I didn't actually tell you what it means for an object to be simple, but it turns out you can sort of write down a bunch of different things you could mean by saying simple. You can say it has no sub-objects except for zero and itself, right? This is sort of the standard definition. You could say it's indecomposable under direct sums, or you could look at its endomorphisms or its high-dimensional endomorphisms and ask those to be one-dimensional. And it turns out that all of these conditions are equivalent. So this is all just completely parallel to what you know from fusion categories. So you could wonder or hope, well, maybe it looks like these higher multifusion categories, they really behave like fusion categories, just in higher dimensions. But that's not quite true. So there's an actual subtlety, and the subtlety is that Schur's lemma doesn't work anymore. Namely, it can happen, and it happens a lot, that you have two simple objects which are connected by a non-zero morphism, but are not isomorphic to one another, right? So in one dimension, by Schur's lemma, being connected is equivalent to being isomorphic. But in higher dimensions, these are just not the same. So you can look at two different objects which are not isomorphic, but which are connected. So that's all sort of standard. Why would one expect something like this? But something cool that turns out in these higher semisimple categories is that being connected is still an equivalence relation. So it's still symmetric, right? You have the identity which goes from every object to itself. But the interesting sort of non-trivial thing that's in here is the transitivity of this relation. So if I have a non-zero morphism from A to B and from B to C, I also have a non-zero morphism from A to C. So in some sense, if you have a bunch of simples and they are pairwise connected, and everyone is connected to at least one of them in this group of simples, then they will all be pairwise connected to one another. And so it makes sense to define the following set. The set of Schur components of one of these higher semisimple categories, where I define two objects to be, in the same component to simple objects if they are connected by a non-zero morphism. And it turns out you can show this is actually the same as being connected by a condensation. So what these sets record is really the objects or the faces in this category, which up to the relation that two of these faces are considered the same if one of them can be obtained by condensation from the other. So this pi zero c is sort of a coarse graining on this category where I'm saying I really just want to distinguish those simple objects that cannot be condensed from one another. Okay, so now I should say a little bit why I'm using this notation here. And this notation clearly comes from homotopy theory. And sort of the whole premise of this conference, of this workshop, is that we should think of fusion categories or higher fusion categories as sort of variants of homotopical spaces. Or sort of invertible, sort of higher groupoids. Yes.
Sorry, could you briefly explain why? So that the phenomenon in n equals to one, is it just a definition issue, or is it like, is there a deeper?
This one here.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is Schur's lemma, which says that if I have a semisimple category and I have two simple objects in there. Then there is a non-zero morphism between them, if and only if the objects are isomorphic.
But it sounds like a definition of semi-simple algebra, right? We created that to model the the representation categories we know.
Yeah, well, you can define you can think of this as sort of being built into what it means to be a semi-simple category, but you can also define semi-simple categories in another way. Yeah, so, I agree, it's a fundamental ingredient of being a semi-simple category.
So the point is that when you go to higher categorical version, it's not natural to.
It's not built in, and it's not natural. And if you take this definition, which I think is fairly minimal in some sense, you have to encode semi-simplicity somewhere, and the rest is sort of just, you know, natural higher categorical conditions you might want to ask about a thing which collects TFTs. Then it just won't happen that connectivity implies isomorphism. Well, and you could, in principle, sort of look at one where this is enforced, but this would sort of severely restrict the examples you have. Okay, so we have this pi zero, and right, as I was saying, this is sort of the fundamental theme, maybe sort of applied to this sort of finite semi-simple setting, is that fusion categories generalize finite groups. Also, something I promised you to say, now you know what finiteness means. Finiteness means you have a finite number of these components. But the setting is that fusion categories generalize finite groups. And in fact, this is really a generalization, not just an analogy. Namely, if I have a finite group and a cocycle on it, I get back a particular fusion category. And you can think of this as sort of the fusion categorical analog of this finite group. And similarly, fusion n categories generalize finite n groups, where by definition, a finite n group is a loop space whose homotopies in high enough degree vanish, and all of these homotopies are finite. And again, this is an actual generalization. If I have a finite n group, I can turn it into a fusion n category, just in the same way as I did for fusion one categories. Okay, so these are really sort of the non-invertible symmetries of which generalize these sort of invertible symmetries that we're seeing here. And so now it does make sense if we've already defined pi zero and said we're sort of, in some sense, a generalization of sort of finite homotopy theory, then we should also define these higher homotopy groups or higher homotopy sets of these fusion categories. How do I define them? Well, I define them sort of in the obvious way. I define pi k of my multifusion n category C to be, I loop this multifusion n category k times. Looping here is sort of a non-invertible version of looping. It means just take sort of the k-fold endomorphisms of the tensor unit, the sort of, you know, a certain type of higher co-dimensional operators. I guess it's co-dimension k plus one operators. And then I take the set of components of this thing. And it does turn out, again, that these sets of components generalize homotopy groups. So if I take one of these finite n groups, turn it into a fusion n category, it might have many, many more invertible objects than my original finite n group. But its set of components is precisely, its sort of pi k is precisely pi k of this higher space. And so we really have somehow this framework here where we can do these sort of things which feel a lot like homotopy theory, but are not quite homotopy theory. It's sort of a non-invertible version of homotopy theory. But we still have these notions of sort of components and homotopy groups. Now you could ask, and a very natural question to ask, especially looking at this, is on these pi kz, do we have the structure of a group? And the answer is no, in general we don't. But we do have a structure of a certain kind of fusion ring. It's a bit subtle. It's not a fusion ring in the usual sense. But there is some sort of information which is essentially equivalent to the data of a fusion ring on these sets. And indeed, in the case where it comes from an invertible symmetry, this fusion ring will degenerate to just being a group structure. And I don't want to say much more about what I mean by this. This is, again, something I'm happy to talk about if anyone is interested. And now let me make just a tiny additional comment I sort of squeezed into these slides a few days ago after I seen Shuheng and Justin's talk. And this is just if you sort of care about these things, this is not relevant for the rest of the talk. But I want to point out that this pi kc, right, I just pointed out that this pi kc usually isn't a group. It is certainly a group if I start with an invertible symmetry. However, it does turn out that even for non-invertible symmetries, in many instances, this does turn out to be a group. There's a priori this fusion ring, but this fusion ring very sort of fairly often, in at least the natural examples, turns out to be a group, even if the symmetry is non-invertible. And this in general happens if I have a simple object X, or if sort of for every simple object X, I can take X tensor its dual, and this is not equal to one. That would mean that X is invertible, but it's still condensable to one, still in the same component of one. And I think this is something we saw in these talks before, where we had somehow the square root of something that's condensed, of a condensation. And that's precisely saying that somehow the set of components does form a group. And these are usually these higher multifusion categories that are somehow better handled, that feel more like homotopy theory. So that's somehow the brief intro and summary about how these higher fusion categories work. Are there any questions at this point?
Great. So in your example, vec omega g, g can be an N group?
Yes.
OK, so in that case, so I'm just comparing with your pi k. So I guess that pi 0, if in the case that g is just a normal one group, then that's the case where only pi 0 is non-trivial, right?
Yes.
OK, very good.
It's debatable whether I should call this pi k or pi k plus or minus 1, right? But yes, this is sort of the way it sort of chooses normalization here. That's right. That's exactly right.
Okay. And I think at some point you said to me that somehow multi-fusion versus fusion has something to do with simply connected or not simply connected. Do we see that in here, or is it?
Yes, so I should, right. In general, I could talk about, so here I'm talking about fusion categories. In general, I could talk about multi-fusion categories. In fact, in general, I should talk about just semi-simple n plus one categories. And then those correspond sort of more cleanly to just homotopy types and not n groups. So this is not sort of, right? There is sort of an unpointed and unconnected version of all of the story, and this would just be finite semi-simple categories.
I see, thanks.
So the fusion corresponds to the fact that I'm having a group rather than a...
So in the case of C being higher categorical Tambara Yamagami, so just group-like surfaces and then the one non-invertible guy, so what would pi k C be? It should be a group, right? What group is it?
Let's talk about this later.
I'm
not
entirely sure.
I mean, I'd have to look at the example. I mean, it's, yeah. But in general, it's operators of codimension k plus one, or I mean, let's ignore the counting here. It's operators of a certain codimension or dimension up to condensation. That's sort of always what it is. So if you have sort of a good enough handle on this category, you can say, you know, how many operators do I have where I count two operators as being equivalent if I can go from one to the other by condensation? That's what pi k is.
Okay.
There's a question coming from chat, which is, so you define the fusion rule up modulo condensation?
Can you repeat that question?
So the question is, so you define the fusion rule up to condensation or modulo condensation?
Yes. So, right, exactly. So this statement is saying there is a sense of fusion rule up to condensation. And that somehow generalizes how homotopy groups sort of have a fusion rule on them. And so it's sort of a good notion. You could define fusion rules up to isomorphism, but I think it turns out in these higher categories, and we see this sort of repeatedly, that the thing that is really supposed to be analogous to homotopy is objects up to condensation. That's really the thing. That's somehow the coarsest quotient. Objects up to isomorphism seem not so relevant in the story than objects up to condensation.
Hi. If I think like a physicist, if I have a two category, the objects are like surfaces, topological surfaces.
Yes.
And when I do fusions, I have to specify the surface in which I do the fusion. And maybe I can get different results. Is this information encoded in something like that?
Yes. So, right. So first you can do fusion of surfaces themselves. There you precisely have it sort of somehow, you start with your monoidal two category, pi zero C encodes what's the fusion of surfaces. And then pi 1 of C encodes what's the fusion of lines that are not, that don't live on surfaces. So you are asking, you know, what happens if I have a line which lives on a surface? And that's not sort of directly encoded in these homotopy groups. So the homotopy groups are really sort of operators that live sort of in the vacuum, and you fuse them there.
Okay. I'm asking also if I do a fusion of two surfaces, but I choose two, like I can do a fusion with two planes or two surfaces that are more complicated. And in one case, maybe I cannot see the condensation. In other, I can see. Is it true, or is something that is encoded in the higher categorical structure?
Yes, I mean, in general, in the higher categorical structure, you basically have encoded all the sort of, if I have two surfaces and I ask in how many ways can it sort of fuse to a single surface of some other type, that's sort of encoded in the monoidal two category. And this pi zero then just records somehow, you know, which surfaces can come up on the other side. in which component do they need to be? That's somehow encoded in this fusion ring, if you want.
Thank you. Yeah.
Sorry, naive question. Can you repeat what do you mean by omega?
Yes. So in this case, if I just want to have a fusion n category and not a fusion n supercategory or sort of an even more complicated enriched type of gadget, if I just want to have a fusion n category, then this omega is an...
No, the other omega, the capital omega.
Oh, the big one. Yes. Yes. No, the big one. Sorry. Yes. Okay. The small one, just to finish the sentence, is a cocycle of a certain degree on the classifying space of this n group. And this capital omega is, I mean, defined as sort of the iterated endomorphisms of one.
Iterated endomorphisms of one.
So it's really, I mean, omega kz is really the co-dimension, I think, k plus one operators, which sort of fly around in the vacuum. Yes.
Sorry, what is the fusion ring defined on? I mean,
this is a basis for this fusion ring, so this pi kz. So for every level k, you have one of these.
No, I mean, it's a ring over the complex numbers.
It's a ring over the complex numbers, yes. And it's in one dimensional, it turns out to be sort of this certain kind of fusion ring. I don't want to talk too much about it because I didn't tell you what I really mean by fusion ring. It will be real number valued, and in these higher dimensions, maybe it also will be real number valued. But a priori, it's just complex number valued. Yeah, so let me continue so that I don't run out of time. And let's sort of replay the same game we just played. And so we have to talk about the higher dimension version of the tangle hypothesis, right? Where can I sort of evaluate these operators on? Where do these defects actually live? Again, this is something you can sort of extract from, for example, from this fantastic paper of Jacob Lurie on the cobordism hypothesis. So if C is some monoidal n category, and I have a fully dualizable n minus k morphism X, then I can evaluate this on an embedded k-dimensional manifold in Rn plus 1. So you can think of this as a k-dimensional operator. But again, I need framing data. And what's the framing data? It's the same framing data as in the one-dimensional case. Only that in the one-dimensional case, you sort of almost didn't really see it. In the higher-dimensional cases, this becomes more and more relevant and looks sort of less and less like an orientation. Namely, I need the tangential framing on the operator itself. I also need a normal framing on this operator. And again, now I have two ways to trivialize the tangent bundle plus the normal bundle. And these two ways need to be related by a homotopy. And once I've sort of fixed all of this data, it does make sense to sort of label a manifold embedded with all of this data, label it by an operator X, by this sort of object, well, higher morphism X in this category. And again, the notation is that I sort of pretend this is just an integral, and usually I just sort of drop all of the framing data from the notation. Okay, and again, as before, this sort of this recipe tells me how to evaluate an operator on any framed n plus one manifold. Because here I'm really using, when I say blackboard framing, right, I'm really using a framing on R n plus one, and I could just replace it with some other n plus one manifold W. Okay. And so now let's sort of again replay the same story we saw before. So suppose we have a fusion n category, and we have some one of these k-dimensional operators. Or co-dimension n minus k operators, I can take this operator and put it on in k minus 1 with a bounding frame. So this is not yet sort of the top-dimensional operators I can put it on. This is still sort of one dimension less. So this doesn't live at the top morphism level. It lives sort of one layer below it. And so it's completely still fine from the cobordism hypothesis to take a sphere with a k tangential framing and some other normal data and homotopy that I sort of will now drop from the discussion for simplicity. And so this is somehow just bounding framing on the k minus 1 sphere. That makes sense. And I do have this evaluation morphism, the disk, which you can draw like this. Right? And the fact that this exists tells me that this tangential framing, at least here, has to be this bounding k framing. However, again, in general dimensions, it doesn't make sense to have sort of a cup closing this off in the other way. Same issue as before. If I would have this, then I would have a k-framed sphere, which doesn't sort of exist in most dimensions. However, now, I said fusion here. So once I'm sort of all the way up at the top level, this is actually a fusion one category. Really, it's often a symmetric fusion one category just by dimension counting. But at least it's a fusion one category. And this object X turns out to be simple if and only if I take this operator, which now lives in a fusion one category, and I can decompose it into simple objects in the just usual fusion one categorical sense. The unit object will appear exactly with multiplicity 1. That's, again, a way to characterize an operator to be simple, by just sort of looking at it at its sort of top minus 1 sphere. And so, again, I have a unique splitting of this map, just by sort of algebra, by semi-simplicity. And And so this is sort of characterized by being sort of a morphism of this shape, so that if I compose these together, I get one. And I should think of this now as placing my object X on this K sphere, but now this K sphere is not equipped with a K framing, it's rather equipped with a K plus one framing. So I have this additional layer of framing. And again, I can sort of explain this from the Cobordus hypothesis perspective, but I think it's nice to think of this as sort of extra little bit of dualizability that these objects have, that I have somehow a value of the K sphere and I have a value of the K disk, of the K plus one disk, which is sort of the quality that this is one. And let me stress, this really needs semi-simplicity. This is something I, again, cannot do in just some monoidal N category. Yes.
Sorry, why do you use spheres? Can you use other manifolds?
Yes, I mean, I can. Yeah. The reason I'm using spheres is that this is what I need for the S matrix, and it turns out this is all I sort of need for this S matrix story and for this theorem. So I'm sort of just focusing on spheres. But yes, you can evaluate my X, I can evaluate it on any K-framed K minus one manifold here and get some object in this category.
But, so
but things like simplicity cannot be expressed. I mean, are sort of easily, most easily expressed in terms of spheres.
But so is there an analogous notion of the S matrix where you link the two manifolds on let's say manifold which are more complicated than spheres?
You could in principle do that, but it's not necessary. Like if you want to get, I mean, I'm going to come to this to the S matrix, and it turns out somehow you don't need. So if you just want to get sort of the fundamental theorem of greater fusion n categories somehow, of sort of higher fusion n categories, which tells you about invertibility of sort of the bike theory, then you don't need to consider these linkings of more complicated manifolds. You can consider these, and these are numbers you get out, but somehow the statement that the matrix is invertible, that's that you just need the S matrix for the spheres for.
What do you mean when you say that it is not needed, that the information?
Okay. Yes, I'll come to that. So okay. I'll tell you, I mean, there's going to be a theorem which just refers to the S matrices for the spheres. Okay. Namely, I mean, this comes now is the definition, right, of this S matrix. And the way I define it here is to say, okay, if X is one of sort of, you know, X is a morphism here, Y is a morphism here, they are simple, then I can link them up. Now I can sort of put them on these spheres. I have sort of this framing trick that I'm allowed to talk about spheres. I take these two spheres, compute sort of the Hopf link on these spheres. That's certainly a number I can extract. As you said, I can extract many more numbers. I could sort of, you know, imagine sort of linking higher dimensional manifolds in some interesting way. But certainly I can link these spheres, and I can link them up. So this is K, this is N minus K, so it just makes sense in precisely the right dimension to sort of be able to link them up as an Rn plus one. And right, since we assume our category is fusion, this is going to be a local point operator in my TFT. And so in particular, it will be valued just in the sort of iterated endomorphisms of one. And since we assume we're fusion, these iterated endomorphisms of one are just the complex numbers or can be identified with the complex numbers. And so this is a number. And maybe the first non-trivial statement is, which is not true if I would link the higher manifolds, the first non-trivial statement is that this pairing, if I'm using these spheres with these sort of fake framings, this actually descends just to the sets of components. And how do you show this? Let me sort of just give you sort of a bit of a short picture proof. If X and X prime are two different elements, this is bad notation. So suppose X and X prime are two different simples in the same component. So I shouldn't have written it like this so that you can scratch out. So suppose X and X prime are in the same component, but are not isomorphic to one another, or not necessarily isomorphic to one another. Then what I can do is I can pick a simple F between them, which is non-zero. So I can pick sort of a boundary condition between these. Now I want to show that this thing is actually invariant independently of whether I take X or X prime on this left side. So let's make the following observation first. So first, I defined this fake framing on the blue sphere to be the one that sort of normalizes this to one, and that uniquely determined this dot down here. So the following, let's sort of create a little F loop here. And again, we use sort of a relative version of this fake framing story, so we can again have something where sort of I can just create this out of nothing. And then I move it around to this side. But now, this down here, this sort of composite thing, this bottom half of the sphere, is some morphism that we don't quite know what it is. But it turns out that, you know, as I said, there is a unique splitting of sort of the top half of the sphere. So both of these morphisms here sort of are uniquely determined by saying if I cup them off with the red sphere, I get one. Right? This one is sort of by definition so that if I cup it off with sort of a red disk, I get one. And this one here is precisely what happens here. So these have to be equal. Okay, so that's the setup. And now we do the proof. Let's start with sort of this Hopf link where I here use this blue sphere. I create this little bubble. I move the bubble around to the other side. The reason I can move this bubble here through this linking is just that I'm, you know, sort of the linking happens in the right dimension so that actually this y here doesn't link anymore with this circle. Sort of this is out of our dimensional reach. And then I use this fact here that these two things are equal. And so I see it actually doesn't depend on which actual simple in this component I'm looking at. And this is something that wouldn't work with more general manifolds. You couldn't sort of move it around in this way. So that's something which is very specific to spheres. And so really we have this S matrix descends for every fixed k, it descends to a pairing between pi k and pi n minus k of this higher semisimple category. And if you want to think of these higher multi-fusion categories or higher fusion categories as generalization of loop spaces of finite n groups, then what this is really doing, this generalizes and you can recover from it the Whitehead bracket. So this is precisely sort of if I have a loop space omega x, this precisely gives you the Whitehead bracket. This data where I identify pi and omega x, which is the complex numbers in this case. And so let's talk about then the theorem, which sort of tells me why I should care as a mathematician as well, and as a physicist about these framed S matrices, and specifically about the framed S matrices for spheres. First, again, as in one of the earlier slides, sort of to give you a physical perspective, you could think about one of these fusion N categories as a framed n plus 2 dimensional TQFT together with an n plus 1 dimensional boundary condition. Again, these things live in some higher Merida category. The bulk theory you should think of really only depending on the Merida class of C, and the boundary condition actually depends on the isomorphism class of C itself. I do need to add a word here, which is separable. We don't yet know whether all fusion n categories are separable. We think that in characteristic zero, all fusion n categories are separable, but the separability sort of keeps track of dualizability. So this is a bit of a subtlety. So maybe I have to add this word separability to really get a field theory. But I mean, this part is mostly for motivation. So the theorem, and again, this is a theorem in progress. So you know, maybe I should write this in inverted commas. The S matrix is invertible for all k, if and only if the Drinfeld center of this fusion n category is trivial, if and only if C is Morita invertible, so the bulk theory is actually invertible, so that we get an invertible bulk theory with a boundary condition. And this proves the conjecture in condensed matter theory by Kong and Wen in 2014, sort of before fusion n categories existed. And it's really important for this theorem to think of the S matrix really as living on the sets of components. So for a long time, I think we didn't believe this conjecture because we knew there were sort of different elements in the same component which had the same S matrix pairing. And it was sort of completely unclear what the conjecture was even doing. But once you descend it to the sets of components, it becomes true. Yes?
For n equals to 1, shouldn't this be about the Müger center?
Yes, so this is a subtlety, that's a good point. So here I'm just talking about fusion n categories. If I start with a braided fusion n category, I can sort of think of its delooping and then complete it, and then I get a fusion n plus 1 category. And the fact that the sort of it's equivalent to ask the Drinfeld center of this fusion n category to be trivial is equivalent to asking the Müger, I mean, in this particular case, is equivalent to asking the Müger center of this lower dimension thing to be trivial. So the Müger center of a braided fusion 1 category is contained in the Drinfeld center of the associated fusion 2 category. So if you just talk about monoidal n categories, you'll always see Drinfeld centers coming up, and you can sort of have, I mean, as a corollary, you get analogous statements if I sort of pass from fusion n categories to braided fusion n minus 1 categories and so on. But that's in some sense the cleanest statement. And so what's the interpretation physically? Physically, this is saying in any semisimple anomalous TQFT, right? Because the moment the bulk is invertible, I can think of this as an anomalous n plus 1d TQFT. It's a boundary condition for some invertible theory. In any semisimple anomalous TQFT, there's a perfect pairing between operators of complementary dimensions up to condensation. So this pairing is only perfect up to condensation. And let me sort of give you a completely evident corollary, which is actually quite powerful, which is if C is Morita invertible, if the bulk is invertible, then you know you have this interesting invertible matrix with interesting numbers in it. But in particular, the matrix is square because it's an invertible matrix. And so it turns out that sort of the set of components pi k of C is precisely, or the cardinality of the set is precisely equal to the cardinality of this set. And that contains quite some interesting information about these higher semisimple categories and these higher T of T's. You can somehow conclude something about operators in dimension k from operators in dimension n minus k. And let me sort of give you an example of this, somehow the easiest case of this, where I just compare 0 and n. If I have an anomalous semisimple TQFT without local operators, without point operators, that's sort of encoded as saying that pi n of c is trivial, then it follows that there are also no interesting codimension 1 operators. Then every codimension 1 operator can be condensed from the vacuum. So only knowing that I sort of only have, you know, a trivial one-dimensional vector space of point operators already tells me that there can't be any interesting codimension 1 sort of higher surface operators. The mathematical version of this is, I mean, this is precisely the same statement, just sort of in mathematics. If C is an invertible fusion n category, or Morita invertible fusion n category, then it's actually of the form modules of a braided fusion n minus 1 category, because every object in there is condensed from the vacuum, condensed from the tensor unit, so I might as well just look at the endomorphism of the tensor unit, which is this braided fusion n minus 1 category. And that then comes back to the question you were asking. This is why somehow for in sort of 2 plus 1 dimensional theories, we usually don't see invertible fusion 2 categories. We just see invertible braided fusion 1 categories. That's somehow entailed in this first statement, because actually every Morita invertible fusion 2 category is just modules of an invertible braided fusion 1 category. And an even easier version of this is if C is a Morita invertible fusion 1 category, then it just has to be the trivial theory. So these are just actually mathematical statements. If you think about them, they're sort of, if you prove them with conventional sort of tools, they're not that easy to prove. You have to do some work. And here they just sort of fall out of this sort of seemingly innocent corollary. And so in the last 1 minute, let me sort of wrap up this talk with a bit of an outlook and things we're sort of currently working on and things that we sort of develop out of this. And this is this idea that somehow a way, if you sort of take this perspective, that multi-fusion n categories or higher semisimple categories are somehow a quantum, a non-invertible version of homotopy types of spaces. Then what's happening with this S matrix here, right? Now we have sort of this higher semisimple categories and we ask this non-degeneracy condition. We ask that the bulk is invertible. And suddenly we start to get something out which feels a lot like some sort of Poincaré duality. Right? We have some of these homotopy groups or homotopy sets, they sort of pair in a non-degenerate way along the middle dimension. So at least to some extent, and at least sort of as an analogy, I think it's a good idea if you think of a fusion n category as being sort of analogous to a topological space, or a homotopy type, you should think of a Morita invertible fusion n category as being analogous to an n-dimensional manifold, or a Poincaré space maybe, then it's just a property of the space rather than additional data. And sort of starting from this observation, you can now ask, is there some sort of surgery theory I can perform on these sort of Morita invertible higher fusion categories? And it turns out there is, and you can actually sort of get quite some mileage out of this. And part of surgery theory is, of course, that you have a Poincaré duality. The other part is you need to know how to kill higher homotopy groups. I would say, I mean, that's probably the actual non-trivial part of it. And there is a procedure you can sort of use to kill these high-dimensional homotopy groups of these higher fusion categories. It's sort of related to some sort of ungauging. You sort of identify these as being gauged theories of something else. And in the end, you end up with some obstruction in the middle dimension, which is sort of the S-matrix pairing of middle-dimensional operators. And sort of if you make this precise, it starts to lead to a classification of these sort of higher modular or higher Morita invertible fusion n categories. But this is all work in progress, so that's all sort of the future. And that's the end of my talk. Thank you for your attention. Here's some references, I should say. This S-matrix story is not yet on the archive or published. In this very last paper here, we sort of use parts of it. So if you want to see sort of a glimpse of these higher S-matrices, there's sort of a bit in there. But the rest is to follow. Okay, thanks for your attention.
So the first question comes from chat a couple minutes ago. Shuheng asks, since the fusion is defined modulo condensation, does that mean the non-invertible defects in his and Justin's talks are invertible in this more generalized sense?
Yes, I probably wouldn't call them invertible, but yes, exactly. They would be invert. They would if I just think of them up to condensation, they would be sort of invertible elements in this fusion ring. Yeah, exactly. That's right. And so maybe sort of to briefly elaborate on this, and you should sort of, just from experience by now, I think if you have one of these higher fusion categories where the components happen to be groups, even though the thing is clearly sort of non-invertible, somehow it's much more amenable to tools which feel like homotopy theory. So there's some invertibility in there that sort of isn't there in a completely generic higher fusion category.
So, okay, one question about the S-matrix. So in like usual one category, modular tensor categories, I would like to compute the S-matrix, and what I would do is to take the R-matrix and use it in this usual formula with fusion and R-matrix, and I would get the S-matrix. Is there some similar relation for this higher S-matrix in terms of more fundamental like quantities in some sense?
Yes, so in some sense you could translate a question into asking, you know, is there some, so you can present your fusion category in terms of, you know, you have your associators, your F matrices and your R matrices, and you have just this linear algebraic data which fulfills some complicated equations, but which you can in principle solve. So does something like this exist for these higher fusion categories? In principle, yes. In practice, I think this hasn't been written down anywhere. So you'd have to make lots and lots of, sort of already for fusion categories, you have to make a lot of choices before you can sort of extract this data. Sort of, you know, there's lots of gauge freedom somehow in doing this. And these choices become more and more complicated for these higher categories. And so you could in principle do it, and I think, a few years ago I've tried, but it just gets out of hand. And so I think it's, somehow the fusion categories we're working with often, they do come from other constructions where I have sort of good access to these various pieces. So I don't usually build them up from scratch, just sort of algebraically, but I say I start with a space, or I gauge some theory I know well, and sort of these constructions are.
Okay, so you can compute the S-matrix by some indirect method, let's say.
Yes,
okay,
exactly. That's sort of, yep.
Yeah, hi David. I have maybe a really basic question, but like if you're satisfied, if it's like, if the bulk theory is actually anonymous, does that mean that the, you know, the homotopy groups, are they actually groups, or can they still not be groups?
So, you are asking, right, if my bulk theory is invertible, so if I am in the setting of this theorem, mm-hmm. Does it then sort of imply that these homotopy groups are actually groups? I think the answer is no, they don't necessarily need to be groups. An example is you can take, an example is you can take Dijkstra-Witten theory and take as your category sort of the operators in Dijkstra-Witten theory. Mm-hmm. And then what the S matrix is essentially is, if you're sort of in high enough dimensions, most of this homotopy is zero, but you have sort of at the top and at the bottom, you have the conjugacy classes in the group, and the other side you have sort of the representations up to isomorphism, and the S matrix is the character table.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's an invertible matrix, but the conjugacy classes in the non-abelian group are not, don't form a group. They still appear as one of these homotopy sets.
Yeah. Okay, yeah,
that would be an example where they're not groups, even you have an anomalous theory. Yes.
Yeah. Suppose you start from an higher category which is not complete under this procedure of condensations.
Yes.
No. Is it unique, the procedure of adding all the condensation to make it complete?
Yes.
Okay. So I have another question. If you start from a category which is not complete and you have your fusion ring, then the fusion ring of the complete category is uniquely determined by the addition of the condensations.
So the first question is certainly yes. So if I have a higher category, the operation of completing with respect to condensation is again an idempotent operation. So if I'm condensation complete and complete again, nothing happens. And you know, if I'm not complete, I can complete once and then I have the unique completed thing. So that's all functorial and idempotent and nice. I don't know whether I would even define the homotopy sets of a non-complete thing. I think you will miss, because then if you also don't have completions at the level of higher operators, I think you might just miss out things. So for the second question, right, I don't even know how to define this fusion ring up to condensation for a non-complete thing.
Okay.
Yeah. But I mean, probably whatever you have in mind might actually just work. I don't really see. So I think if you just have a subset of the components, well. No. Yes. No. I guess you're right. You could still do it. If you don't have everything in there, the set of sort of objects up to condensation still makes sense, because of course once you condensation complete, you just add more objects that are still identified with the other objects you anyways already had. It might just happen that your fusion is not closed before you're not complete any condensation.
So yeah, exactly. My question was whether I write my fusion and I notice that it's not closed under condensation, and closing under condensation, I actually get that right.
Yes. So if you if you start with something where your fusion of objects is closed under is like still contained in the category and you don't have to condense. And there might be other things that you can condense too, but you can ignore them. Then yes, I think from this data you can already extract the fusion ring. You can certainly extract a set of components, and I think you can also extract the fusion ring.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. All right, a couple questions from chat. So first, let's say I have a modular tensor category C and a connected, separable, commutative algebra A. So is it true that the category of local A modules is a dual of C, and the category of right A modules is a condensate? I guess A is an algebra in C for this question.
Yes. If the algebra, that's right, exactly.
Okay.
That's just right, yes.
Cool. Next question, is there a generalization of the Verlinda formula to extract fusion rules from these higher S matrices?
Fantastic question. B, I haven't thought about it. And C, that should be all I'm going to say about this. Yes, no, I can't say anything concrete about this. I think this is a great question. There might indeed be something like this. Who asked this question? I think this is a really cool question.
Let me see if I can get their full name, but Rajat? No last name given, just Rajat.
Yes.
Sorry, Rajat Radhakrishnan.
Okay.
So you've used semi-simplicity at all levels to like get a hold of these fake framings and get around these framing issues of like trying to evaluate on spheres. Presumably, if you had an N category with sort of, I don't know, for like the equivalent of ribbon structures, except like for the full N dimensions, all this framing data, you could write down such a thing.
Yes.
In the absence of semi-simplicity. Yes.
That's right.
So in the classical surgery story, one of the things they needed, because like the even dimensional spheres aren't parallelizable, they needed to use stable framings. Mm-hmm. Have you thought about like trying to use stable framings at all?
I mean, you can think of, I won't scroll back 65 slides, but this fake framing story, I mean, I was sort of always alluding to, you know, there's some Cobordism hypothesis story here that you can sort of play off. Essentially what you give, say, if I'm not working in a fusion N category, but just in some symmetric N category when it's really just about framings, then essentially this fake framing sort of lifts the fact that my object has a structure group which sort of corresponds to it being equipped with an N framing to it being equipped with an N plus one framing. You can ask what happens it being equipped with an N plus two framing, and that is actually already the stable world. So this fake framing together with an additional property brings you into the world of stable frame. So this is almost stable framed. It's sort of one layer more than the Cobordism hypothesis gives you for free, and it's sort of one layer less in these N categories than being stably framed. But it's enough for, I mean, the spheres that we're looking at are basically the interesting spheres also from the stably framed perspective.
Thanks.
So we got one more question coming from chat, which is, can this looping act on any idempotent or just on the tensor unit?
Yeah, so this looping can act on any object. So if I start with some semi-simple N category, I can define the loop on any object as sort of just the endomorphisms of that object. But if I'm having a sort of connected multifusion category with a base point, a connected semi-simple category with a base point, which is sort of a multifusion N minus one category, then it does make sense to just consider these higher. I mean, it just contains sort of enough relevant information about these higher categories if I just look at these endomorphisms of the tensor unit and of iterated sort of identities on the tensor unit, just like for homotopy types. But I can also look at path spaces and sort of more complicated sort of spaces of homotopies between complicated other homotopies. But sort of by invertibility in this case, it turns out I just need to know these endomorphisms of one. And here I don't have invertibility, but somehow by these fake framing tricks, you basically, I mean, at least to extract sort of this sort of information, you also again just need higher endomorphisms of one. So again, right, this world, somehow the semi-simple world, something that I find really exciting about it is that it does, it's much closer to homotopy theory than just plain n categories for some magical reason.
All right, have we any more questions? Okay, well, let's thank David again.